All right, what they're handing out, actually, Josh, can I snag one of those before you go any further? What they're handing out is actually a list of kings in Judah and Israel. This is not a complete list. We stop at the end of Micah's ministry. Tonight, what I'm going to do is just take a little bit of time and give you some greater background material to the book of Micah. So this is going to be more teachy this evening, and I just wanted a chance to do this at some point, and tonight is a good night to do this. The handout that is in front of you that's coming around, it's not a perfect handout. I'm hoping I got all the names spelled correctly. Spell check does wonderful when you're trying to do these things, and they keep auto-correcting stuff and doing all of that kind of thing. So forgive me if you see any errors. Actually, if you see any errors, text me, email me, jot a note down so I can get this right for my files for the future. Also, I want to note that there's a couple of things just in general you'll see. One is, that, again, it's not a complete list of kings. It ends with Hezekiah, king of in the southern kingdom of Judah, and also when Israel falls in 722 BC, maybe someday I'll produce actually a full list. Second, some of the dates they're not hard and fast, okay, but they're all within a year or two, and the reason is that you have scholars that debate over which date exactly this lines up with. When you read in, for instance, your Old Testament, it'll say something like, "And such and such king reigned 22 years in his father's place." Well, the problem is when you say 22 years, it's hard to know. Does that mean, say, like starting in the year 2020 and finishing in 42? So that could be considered 22 years, or it could be, even if it's one day in one year and one day in the following year, that could be considered years at the front and back end. And that was historically the way they did things. It's not inaccurate by its own time standard. So there's a few dates that are debated. And then just in general, of course, we're dealing with stuff here. If you start with Saul at the top of the list, we're dealing with stuff that's nearly 3,000 years old. And so trying to date anything that old gets rather difficult. However, in general, the dates are pretty good. Third, I'm also borrowing a lot of this. I need to give credit to a college teacher of mine in my sophomore year. I took Old Testament survey, and he'd done a ton of work on this. And he is the one that I'm borrowing much of this material for. There's some slight variations in there by a fellow by the name of Bob Radford. And he was a good, faithful teacher for me. And so a lot of this comes from him. All right. My favorite story, by the way, about Dr. Radford was that his favorite line to say to a bunch of college freshmen and sophomores was, "It's always easier to ask forgiveness than permission." Well, that did not make the deans happy, but he loved to say that in the college classes, and everybody loved him for it. Tonight, we're just going to give some broader background material to the book of Micah, and one of the reasons we have to do this is because most people, quite frankly, have not studied the prophets very much. All right, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but if I did and I asked, how many people have done an extensive study on one of the minor prophets? Most people would have to answer no. Now, I'm in this group tonight, there would be a higher percentage than average Christians, because I know many of you are faithful in your study of the Bible, but most people answer no. As such, many people know very little about the prophets, about them themselves, how to read them, or even anything about their history, where they fit in the narrative of things. And to give you an example of what this would mean practically, I want you to imagine that you receive a newspaper article that was written in Germany, translated into English, and the newspaper article was written from 1885. And you're just given that article, without any context of current events or what led up to the events of 1885. And how many people here would be prepared to really understand what is actually going on in that article? Anybody know what went on in 1885 in Germany? Anybody know? Good, neither do I. I literally just pulled that date. out of my hat, all right? What's that?
I think the Kaiser was busy.
Something was going on. Yeah, something was going, yeah. The sun came up, yes, right? So, and it illustrates a point, though, is that if you try to read some of the Old Testament prophets and you just literally know nothing about what's going on in the context, it's no wonder that a lot of people get confused by them, right? And so this will help, I think, tonight not only set the stage for Micah, but also some other surrounding prophets. For instance, another one that was alive and prophesying during most of Micah's ministry, in effect, a little more, and that of Isaiah. Everything I say tonight will help you understand him as well as Amos, who comes right before Micah. And so you have a number of prophets that this will help with. But specifically for us, as we're endeavoring to learn about Micah on Sunday mornings, this will hopefully help you a little bit. Now, our story for Micah begins with two kings in particular. Just, we've got to back up a little bit before him. The first you'll see on the right side of the column, and that is Jeroboam II. He reigns from 782 to 753. And then right across from him, and you'll see there's a large gap between Uzziah and Jotham, we have the reign of Uzziah from 767 through 740. That date for Uzziah, by the way, is a little bit deceiving. He actually co-reigned with Amaziah, his father, from 792 to 767, and that actually gave essentially a 52-year stable reign in Judah. But if you notice that Jeroboam II actually had quite a long reign himself, nearly 30 years, Uzziah 52 years, side by side. It was actually, for both Israel and Judah, an extremely prosperous time. In the case of Uzziah, his reign and the prosperity that happened for Judah during his reign really almost rivaled that of Solomon's. I mean, it was just a rich, good time of peace, by and large, for the nation of Judah. Jeroboam was a wicked man, but because of a lot of geopolitical things happening, Assyria was still not at its full strength of power. Syria was declining in power. Egypt was not a serious threat. It meant that Israel, trapped in between all of these nations, experienced a pretty good time during that era. And these two kings bring us right up to the threshold of Micah's ministry, because if you read in Micah chapter 1 and verse 1 that Micah, it says, the word of the Lord came to him during the kings of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So these two prosperous kings bring us close to the time of Micah. As I mentioned, the northern kingdom of Israel had a very prosperous time under Jeroboam II. After he died, everything fell apart for Israel. I mean, literally everything. It was a horrible time to have Jeroboam die, because that happened right at the time when Assyria to the north was under a great boom and was posing a huge national threat. Now, what's actually astounding, if you look at the timeline, you notice that Jeroboam died in 753, and you look all the way down at that right column, down to 722, you'll notice there that just about 30 years, you go from a boom time in Israel's history to Samaria, the capital city, being wiped out. That, by the way, should be a sobering reminder to any nation that we might think that we are powerful, but it does not take much for nations to go. Kingdoms rise and fall. 30 years is not very long, right? Not very long. And if you would have asked anybody during Jeroboam II's reign, are you worried about Samaria? You're worried about the northern kingdom? Of course, the answer would have been no. Things were great. Things were glorious. But by the end of Jeroboam's reign, things took a disastrous turn, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Judah also, by the end of Uzziah's reign, was going to enter into a dark time as well. By the time you get to Ahaz in 732 BC, this is on the left side of your column, the pagan practices of Israel were all over Judah. And in fact, we'll read this in just a few moments, that Ahaz himself embraced them and did some horrific things. We'll read that in 2 Kings. Things were not in a good position for them either. Now, in the south, after Uzziah died, his son Jotham reigned, and Jotham also co-reigned with his father Uzziah for the last 10 years of Uzziah's life. When he took over, here is how the Bible describes him in 2 Kings 15. And you may, if you'd like, want to turn to 2 Kings 15. We'll be in 2 Kings 15 and 16 for a little bit here this evening. We weren't going to read all the way through it, but we'll reference some verses there. But in 2 Kings 15 and verse 32, we read this about the ascendancy of Jotham to the throne. Again, he had co-reigned with Uzziah for about 10 years, and now Uzziah has died. By the way, that's a famous thing. You remember in Isaiah chapter 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I also saw the Lord. We're used to that. I mean, that's where that fits in to this timeline. 2 Kings 15:32 says this, "In the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king." And just by the way, stop and think, he had been co-reigning with Uzziah before that. And he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. However, we have this note, and this was frequent for these kings of Judah. The high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. However, he built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. Now, when we read that high places stuff, these are the pagan worship centers for Baal, but also other false gods, including Molech and other gods in that area, in the surrounding area. And they were apparently in use. I think what this should tell us is that Jotham did seek to obey God and keep Jerusalem pure, but a cancer by this point is already growing and spreading in his nation. It's already there. And that, by the way, accords well with what Micah talked about. Remember this morning, he says that the disease is already upon you, Samaria, to the north, and now it's coming down to my home region. Well, this happens over a period of time where the southern kingdom of Judah, that maintained its righteousness a lot longer than the northern kingdom did, it's already spreading down. Now, part of us might wonder, why did Jotham not deal with this? Why did he not deal with the spreading cancer? Well, part of the answer might be that, remember that kings in this era are not dictators by and large. They're not dictators by and large.
So, sacrifices to God on the high places?
That probably the answer is yes. And that the proper term we use for that is syncretism, where you mix two different religions in one. And there was
that would be the reason why
possibly that's part of it. The other thing to remember is that he's 25 years old. He's trying to consolidate power. And we think of today, often we misunderstand monarchies to think that it's like, once they're kings, they can do whatever they want. That's not really true. In the same way that actually a dictator can only go so far before the other powerful people rise up. And what this, I think, indicates is that already the disease of false worship was all over the nation, and he was not able to fully deal with it. But no doubt that probably played into that. There's great mass confusion among the people at this time about the true worship of the Lord.
Isaiah chapter 1 clearly indicates that there was a worship of the Lord, but it was all surface. And a lot of people that are practicing that, at the same time practicing idolatry.
Yep.
That's what he says in Isaiah chapter 1.
Yep.
So yes, there's some tepid, quote-unquote, Judaism going on, but it's all surface garbage.
Yeah.
Something God doesn't tolerate.
More than likely, Jotham would have tried to keep the capital city pure, but he was not able to take care of the rest of the area. And I think that we should say, you know, we feel in one sense sympathetic to him, but also the fact that 2 Kings mentions that he doesn't take away the high places should indicate to us that he should have. He should have risked it politically, and it was a political risk and done it. We're going to see that his grandson, Hezekiah, will do this. Right?
Isn't that somewhat similar in how that the kings back in those days would marry the neighboring, whoever, into their families, pagan families? And they weren't supposed to. God told them, warned them, said, no, don't intermarry with the nations around you.
That happened with Ahab and some of the Israelite kings, but we don't see that. I don't think that any of the Judean kings did that. At least not up to this point. I could be wrong on that. But there is that political power consolidation alliance stuff that happens. And by the way, it may not happen today through marriage, but you look at the history of our own country, you know, go back early on, we hate England, we love France, then we hate France, and we love England, and I don't know where we stand today. Yeah, you hate Germany, love Germany. It goes back and forth, times change, people change, and you have some of that going on as well. Now, we also read this about Jotham in 2 Kings 15:37 during his reign. It says this, in those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Pekah was the king of Israel. Note here that Syria, not Assyria, had at this time joined forces with Israel. That coalition was an anti-Assyrian coalition that was trying to unite their powers to ward off any perceived enemies. And they're flexing their combined muscle and decide to afflict Judah at this point. But this was an early warning shot to the people of Judah that judgment was going to come. And it's interesting how 2 Kings described that the Lord sent him. That, by the way, is a fulfillment of the covenant promises made in Deuteronomy, where Moses and the people swear their promises before the Lord, and one of the things that would happen is if they violated the covenant, God was going to send other nations to afflict them. And that actually happens here in a small way, but it's going to grow to a larger way in 2 Kings 15 and verse 37. So Judah's caught up a little bit in this, and so you also see that Israel and Judah are not always on the same side, and that kind of comes and goes throughout those divided kingdoms' history. Now back to Israel on the right side of the column. After Jeroboam reigns, you have a series of kings that come on the scene after Jeroboam II dies. It was a disastrous series for the northern kingdom. And you can see the list there, and if you notice, most of the kings from Zechariah to Pekah did not reign very long, and in fact did not live very long. The reason for that is because all but Menahem were assassinated. So that meant Zechariah, Shalom, Pekahiah, and Pekah were all assassinated. Zechariah, 2 Kings records this, he only reigned for 6 months. Shalom comes and kills him, and he only makes it 1 month in his reign. What a glorious time to be a king. And it just continues on. Menahem comes and executes Shalom, and he lives and then dies naturally, but then Pekahiah, which would have been the son of Menahem, was executed by Pekah, and then Pekah himself was assassinated, by Hoshea. All right. So when I say that after Jeroboam, a whole bunch of bad stuff happened to Israel, I mean, that should tell the whole story. Can you imagine over a period of 30 years in our own country to have that many presidents assassinated? What do you think that would do to the stability of a nation? All right. Just even one, when that happens, it rocks us to the core. This would have been a serious, serious thing. During this period, on top of that, Assyria was on a quick and powerful rise. They were led by a king with a name that I love in history. You can read it in 2 Kings. Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser. Actually, technically speaking, in history, is Tiglath-Pileser III, though you won't read that third part in the Bible, but that's just a way for scholars to differentiate the various Assyrian kings. What is really helpful for us is not only do we have the biblical record of what he did to Assyria, also archaeologists have found the chronicles and annals of several of the Assyrian kings, including Tiglath-Pileser. And you can compare notes as to what he says and what the Old Testament says, and amazingly, they correspond rather well, all right? And it's clearly that this is not ahistorical, what you read about in 2 Kings. This king, Tiglath-Pileser, was called Pul in 2 Kings 15:19. That's his personal name. His actual reigning name was Tiglath-Pileser III. Here's what we read of him in 2 Kings 15:19 during the reign of Menahem. Pul, king of Assyria, came against the land of Menahem and gave Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his control. That corresponds perfectly with Tiglath-Pileser's own Assyrian records. He records in 743 BC that he went on a marching raid and exacted tribute from Carchemish, Harmath, Tyre, Byblos, Damascus, and Samaria, which is exactly what the Bible records. Now notice, if you've got your Bibles open, in 2 Kings 15:19, that Menahem actually paid the king of Assyria. And he does so for two reasons. First, because he doesn't want the Assyrian king crushing him, right? But second, you have that statement to strengthen the kingdom under his control. It seems that Menahem was trying to use the king of Assyria to help him maintain control over his kingdom. And that makes sense. If you just went and executed the last king and the king before him was also assassinated as well, you're worried about your own skin. So let's borrow from this powerful king to the north of us to help put a stamp of approval. So there's kind of an uneasy alliance that happens here. I'll pay you so that you don't take me over, but also, will you please make sure that my kingdom stands strong? And right here, it's at this point that the northern kingdom of Israel essentially is going to enter into a puppet stage of kings, where they just got puppet kings being controlled by foreign governmental powers. They're relying at this point on the Assyrians, and that's a dangerous alliance because the Assyrians were bloodthirsty people who were not going to be satisfied with just money for long. They're going to want a whole lot more. Now, Menahem did, in order to pay off Assyria, did this in 2 Kings 15:20. In order to make that happen, here's what we read there. And Menahem exacted the money from Israel, from all the very wealthy, from each man 50 shekels of silver to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned his back and did not stay there in the land. This was a very heavy tax on the people in order to make this tribute. After Menahem, Pekahiah, his son, reigned in his place. He only lasts 2 years. You can see him from 742 to 740. Pekahiah had an officer named Remaliah. His son was named Pekah, or Pekah. He created a coup and had Pekahiah assassinated. Incidentally, if you read the longer history of this, Pekahiah was actually co-reigning with Pekah. But apparently, Pekah couldn't take him anymore and had him killed. All right, so another uneasy alliance there in the kingdom. During Pekah's reign, Tiglath-Pileser came back again. This time, he did not accept money. 2 Kings 15:29 records this: Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abelbeth, Maacah, Janoeth, Kedesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. In other words, by this point, tribute was not acceptable anymore. He wanted land and he wanted the people, presumably to make them slaves. It's possible that during Pekah's reign he was not able to pay tribute anymore or didn't pay anymore, but it's difficult to know that for certain. The Bible doesn't record that, but it's possible, just given what the geopolitical times were then, that that's what happened. Now, by the time you get to Pekah there, you'll see that's during Micah's ministry. And so when Micah prophesies that judgment is going to come to Samaria The Samaritan people, the people of the northern kingdom, should have realized this is not an idle threat. This would not be like me saying, you know, it's quite possible that 100 years from now, Canada is going to take us over. All right, and you go, that's crazy, that's so far off. Okay, this would have been like actually during the Revolutionary War, me saying, you know, it's possible that in 5 years, England is going to come and totally snuff us out. And that was possible, by the way. We barely won in the Revolutionary War. It was not an easy fight. In fact, through most of the Revolutionary War, it looked like we were going to lose. So Samaria and the people of the Northern Kingdom should have known that Micah's prophecies were not idle threats. This was a serious thing. Apparently, during the time of Pekah, as he loses all of these key cities in the northern kingdom, there's social unrest. And that would make sense. The northern kingdom would not have been happy. And it made a ripe time for political unrest. And here's what 2 Kings 15:30 records. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck and killed him, so he reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Interestingly enough, Tiglath-Pileser records in his annals that he set Hoshea on the throne and received tribute from him. What that likely indicates is that Hoshea, like the previous guy, Menahem, used the Assyrians to gain power and thus made Israel even more of a puppet state. So probably that actually happened there. Now, just looking at this list of guys from Zechariah down to Hoshea, what kind of words would be good individual words to describe these kind of leaders, right? Thugs, you know, warlords, bloodthirsty, evil, wicked, self-centered. They're not interested in serving the people. They're interested in their own power. Now, have that in mind if you go this week and read through Micah and see how Micah describes some of the various leaders in the northern kingdom as well as in the southern kingdom. No, they got what they deserved. No, that's a good question. But even still, there is no excuse for leadership to follow the people that isn't leaders. You know, these are self-centered men who are only interested in power. And this has been played out 10,000 times in human history, right? I mean, you just read the history of so many countries. It's full of this kind of a thing. Hoshea was enjoying his plush state when a big change happened in Assyria. Tiglath-Pileser died, and he was succeeded by Shalmaneser V. You read his name in 2 Kings. Hoshea paid him tribute for a while to keep him away, but Hoshea realized that during this change of kings, if you were trying to get under the thumb of out from under the thumb of Assyria, now would have been a good time to do that. So he conspired with the king of Egypt for them both to quit paying for the tribute payments. But Shalmaneser of Assyria discovered the plot. He put the king of Egypt into prison, and he marched upon Samaria, and he besieged it for 3 years. The Assyrians, when they besieged the city, it was utter brutality. When they took over, it was revolting and disgusting. I read, remember a few weeks ago, preaching in Psalm 150, the descriptions of what they would do to their conquered peoples, that's the kind of thing that was going to happen to Samaria. So when we read this morning about Micah's prophecy that the Samaria was going to be utterly destroyed and laid waste, this is what was going to happen at the end of that. Real quick.
I did some reading on some of the atrocities that they committed, and the crucifixion was starting with that.
A form of that was started, yes, was started under the Assyrians. Yeah, they were violent people. Read Nahum to see what God thinks of them. It's really, really bad. During the middle of the siege, Shalmaneser died, and he was replaced by Sargon II. Most historians believe that there was probably foul play involved there in the Assyrians as well. But in any case, Sargon defeated Hoshea and deported a huge number of the surviving citizens of Samaria. He records that he deported 27,290 citizens, which were probably pretty much everybody that was left in the city that didn't die from the siege and the war that ensued. Now, all of these actions from Pekah to Hoshea would have been during the lifetime or close to it of Micah. To the south in Judah, things were not looking good either. Ahaz, you see that on the left side of your column, succeeds his father Jotham. Jotham was a good guy, the Bible records, but Ahaz was not. He was evil. Let's just listen to what 2 Kings 16:1 through 4 says. In the 17th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Indeed, this is a stunning statement, and this is a dramatic turn in the history of Judah. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Does anybody know what that passing through the fire was? That was for Molech, where you would offer child sacrifice upon his burning arms in the fire. Horrific thing. And notice here that in Judah, we've moved past just the, not only just the sexual sins of Baal, right into child sacrifice taking place. That's during Micah's prophetic ministry. And that will help you to understand why it is such so full of such just viciously judgmental language. These are horrible atrocities at every level. Ahaz was afflicted by Israel and Syria during this time, not Assyria, during Assyria. It was during Ahaz's reign that Isaiah confronted him about putting his trust in the Lord. And we get that great promise in Isaiah 7 about Emmanuel, God with us. And remember, Isaiah pleads to Ahaz, in essence, to say, just trust God. Don't trust in foreign leaders. Trust God. God is with us. And from the onslaught of the northern kingdom of Israel and Syria. But of course, did Ahaz trust the Lord? No, he did not. Instead, Ahaz now turns to Assyria and seeks help from him. And just think of the utter absurdity of this. I mean, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom are essentially playing a little ping pong match. And both of them are borrowing from Assyria to try to gain power. Now, what happens next under Ahaz's reign is utterly stunning, and it shows us the depravity of his heart. He makes this alliance with Tiglath-Pileser, and they go to Damascus, which is the capital of the capital city of Syria. They capture and destroy it. And listen to 2 Kings 16:10 through 18. We're nearly done here. Now, King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And there he saw an altar that was at Damascus, and King Ahaz sent to Urijah, the priest, the design of the altar and its patterns according to all its workmanship. Now, you get the picture here? They're going with a foreign king to a foreign city, and they're going to level it. And while he's there, he sees this altar to a pagan god, and we might think he takes a picture of his cell phone with his cell phone, and snaps it back to the high priest, but in this case, they had somebody draw out the dimensions of this and send it back to the high priest and told him, basically, build it. That's what you see in verse 11. Then Urijah, the priest, built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah, the priest, made it before King Ahaz came back from Damascus. So after they destroyed Damascus, we read in verse 12, and when the king came back from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and made offerings on it. So he burned his burnt offering and his grain offering, and he poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. Verse 13, you know what all those offerings were? They were all required under the Old Testament law. This is getting right what you're getting at. This is an ultimate form of syncretism, where you're mixing the various offerings, mixing with the various religious practices. He also, verse 14, brought the bronze altar, which is before the Lord, from the front of the temple, from between the new altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the new altar. He altered the altar. He moved it from the place that God had designated in the temple, totally destroying the covenant and the law that God had laid down. Then, verse 15, King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, on the great new altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening grain offering, the king's burnt sacrifice and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offering, their drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood of the burnt offerings and all the blood of the sacrifice, and the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. He's using it as now a token way to pray to God, whatever that meant. Then Urijah, the priest, did according to all that King Ahaz commanded. Now let's just think of the utter absurdity of this. They literally go and level the city where this false altar was at. Obviously, whatever the god was from that altar didn't answer the prayers. So Ahaz has the bright idea of taking a copy of that altar and putting it back in Jerusalem and saying, ha, now I can worship God. I mean, it's insane. It's utterly insane. This all took place during Micah's prophetic ministry. And we read on in verse 17, King Ahaz cut off the panels of the carts, removed the lavers from them. He took down the sea from the bronze oxen that were under it, and he put it on a pavement of stones. Also, he removed the Sabbath pavilion, which they had built in the temple, and he removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria. Utterly stunning. And all of this actually becomes extremely important to Micah's prophetic ministry. By the way, that's what makes the guy who follows Ahaz so remarkable, Hezekiah, because Hezekiah comes to reign during this kind of debauchery and utterly reverses everything. He throws his entire lot upon the Lord. And part of that was actually due to what Micah told him. All right? Micah actually, he was one of the one king during Micah's prophetic ministry that actually listened to the word of the Lord. And we'll see snapshots of that in Micah's prophetic book. So that's just a little background material. I know that's a little teachy tonight, but I hope that will help you as you do your own study and as we go forward in our preaching and teaching time. I'm way over time, so I'm going to pray and then I'll have you be dismissed. Father in heaven, thank you for each one that is here tonight. Bless us now as we go our separate ways, and may we learn from your servants of old like Micah and his careful explanation of your word. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.